Headlines: Iran says U.S. failure to give assurance about Tehran's enjoyment of full economic benefits of the 2015 deal is a main obstacle to its revival. Syria says Israel's nuclear activities pose a major threat to regional and international security, calling for comprehensive inspections of the regime's nuclear facilities. Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr demands the dissolution of parliament and new national elections, saying that he is not interested in negotiating with his rivals. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's UN ambassador says U.S. failure to give assurance about Tehran's enjoyment of full economic benefits of the 2015 deal is the main obstacle to its revival. Majid Takht-e Avanchi made the remark in an address to the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. He said the U.S. withdrawal from the deal in May of 2018 and reimposition of unilateral sanctions prevented Iran's enjoyment of the deal's economic benefits. Iran's envoy said the country has been negotiating in goodwill with other parties to the deal to resume full implementation of the accord. Takht-e Avanchi said Iran will return to full implementation of the deal when the U.S. makes the right decision. Since America's withdrawal, the remaining parties have held several rounds of talks to revive the deal. Talks have failed to make breakthroughs due to U.S. failure to show goodwill and its excessive demands. A new round of talks is due to start in the Austrian capital. Iran's top negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani has called on the U.S. to seize this latest opportunity. Iran's defense ministry has displayed its various products during an exhibition in Tehran titled "The Defense Ministry's Capabilities in Knowledge-Based Production and Economy," Salman Kujuri reports.
Iran's defense ministry has held an exhibition on its capabilities in knowledge-based production and economy. The event covers such fields as transportation, health and medical equipment, security, energy, information and communication technology, cyberspace, construction and mining, industry, petrochemicals, food security and agriculture, as well as household appliances, electronic parts and geographic data and information. In general, 1,100 products in various fields have been put on display at the exhibition.
The ministry's management team has been cooperating with more than 6,000 knowledge-based companies. The localization of products, expanding in-depth knowledge and technology, and creating synergy among the relevant institutions are on the ministry's agenda. The Defense Ministry is responsible for empowering and upgrading Iran's defense industry capabilities while using its knowledge to contribute to production of non-military products.
Iran has repeatedly voiced its readiness to provide advanced scientific and military technologies to friendly and neighboring states. Because it has already achieved self-sufficiency and scientific capabilities in the field of military power and manufacturing state-of-the-art, weaponry.
Holding such exhibitions will provide an opportunity to learn more about the potential and capacities of the private, knowledge-based companies and make use of their potentials for defense-related productions.
Meanwhile, Iran's defense minister has announced that in the coming days, his ministry would unveil a series of new defensive achievements.
According to Iranian officials, as a result of cooperation between Iran's defense ministry and knowledge-based companies, the capacity of the ministry for production has increased by over 20 times in the past couple of years. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Syria says Israel's nuclear facilities pose a major threat to regional and international security and must be subjected to comprehensive inspections by the UN Nuclear Agency. Bassam Sabah made the remark while addressing the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. He said Israel continues to refuse to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty due to unbridled support from the U.S. and its Western allies. Sabah added that Syria offered a resolution on making West Asia a nuclear-free zone in 2003, but it was blocked by the U.S. Israel, which pursues a policy of deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, is estimated to have hundreds of nuclear warheads in its arsenal. The occupying entity has so far refused to either allow inspections of its nuclear facilities or sign the non-proliferation treaty. Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has demanded the country's parliament be dissolved in order to pave the way to hold new national elections. Sadr made the remark in a televised address calling for a peaceful process leading to what he called a democratic election after the dissolution of parliament. He said most Iraqis are angry with the ruling class in its entirety. He Sadr added that he has no interest in negotiating with his rivals. Since 5 days ago, Sadr supporters have occupied parliament in protest at the nomination of Mohammed Shia al-Sudani as prime minister. According to Iraq's constitution, parliament can only be dissolved by a majority vote of lawmakers or by the prime minister after the president's agreement. Sadr's bloc emerged as the biggest faction from the latest elections last October, but still far short from a majority. He ordered his bloc's 73 lawmakers to quit parliament in June after failing to nominate a prime minister. Iran's foreign minister has made a blistering attack on the U.S. over its policy toward China following the controversial visit of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that Washington's provocative acts have become the main source of threat to global peace and stability. Top Iranian diplomat said respecting the territorial integrity of countries is among the well-known foundations of international law. He said in this framework, the Islamic Republic of Iran supports the One China policy as an indisputable fact. China slammed the U.S. actions in Taiwan as extremely dangerous after U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi arrived in the island for a visit. The controversial visit has inflamed tensions between the superpowers. China says Taiwan is part of its territory. Now the U.S. has announced the killing of al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in a drone strike in Afghanistan. The timing of his killing is somewhat questionable. After all, Zawahiri had been on the run for over 20 years following the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Now the U.S. announced his killing months after it withdrew forces from the country it had occupied.
The United States says it has killed the al-Qaeda leader in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri has apparently been killed by a CIA drone strike over the weekend.
After carefully considering the clear and convincing evidence of his location, I authorized a precision strike that would remove him from the battlefield once and for all.
Biden claimed that no civilians were killed in the strike, but the U.S. is known for undercounting civilian casualties. Back in August 2021, the U.S. killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Initially, the U.S. military claimed the strike killed ISIS-K members.
It was announced by the United States military that a drone strike in Kabul had killed a ISIL operative who was getting ready, that they had caught him on the verge of another suicide attack at the airport. And then the United States was congratulating itself for saving lives. The story fell apart very quickly in the next few days. And even though the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, called it a righteous strike, it turned out that this was a man named Samari Amari, who was an employee of a California-based NGO, humanitarian organization, called Nutrition and Education.
Afghanistan's ruling Taliban group have confirmed the strike and described it as a violation of the country's sovereignty, but they have not commented on Zawahiri's death. Zawahiri was 71 years old when he was killed in the drone strike. His death is seen as the biggest blow to al-Qaeda since his former leader Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. troops in Pakistan in 2011. He had apparently taken over the leadership of the group after bin Laden's death. Zawahiri grew up in Egypt and was a surgeon. He later joined bin Laden and is said to have masterminded the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Since 9/11 in 2001, he had been on the run and had a $25 million bounty on his head. Al-Qaeda has yet to issue a statement on his killing. Back in 2020, the United States signed an agreement with the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. The agreement paved the way for the disastrous departure of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Based on the agreement, the Taliban had promised not to allow the presence of terrorist elements on Afghanistan's territory. Now, the United States accused the group of violating that deal.
Now, there have been numerous reports about U.S. ties with former al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. Some sources have said the CIA had ties with him and the so-called Afghan Arab fighters. This is when the U.S. armed Mujahideen group to fight during the Soviet-Afghan War.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks. The aim of the mission was to root out al-Qaeda militants. The mission, which has lasted nearly 20 years, cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of Afghan civilians. The U.S.-Taliban deal showed that Washington failed to reach its objectives. But Afghanistan was the victim of hawkish U.S. politicians even before the 9/11 attacks.
Yes, well, the United States has been supporting terrorism. The al-Qaeda itself is an offshoot of outgrowth, as the Taliban, of U.S. support for insurgents who were resisting the Soviet invasion in 1979. This is our creation. Even Osama bin Laden himself was on the CIA payroll and was being praised by American presidents as a freedom fighter. So we have this history.
It's now a well-established fact that the United States helped create the al-Qaeda in the 1980s against the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. The operation to create al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was masterminded by the United States and financed by the Saudis. And the logistical work was carried out by Pakistan.
We also have a history of kind of moving in and out of Pakistan. I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan. And we did not want to see them control Central Asia. And we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what? Sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military. And let's go recruit these Mujahideen. And that's great. Let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam, so that we can go beat the Soviet Union.
Leaked emails also show that Hillary Clinton, the then U.S. presidential candidate, was furious over the money channeled by Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf Arab countries to terrorist groups like al-Qaeda and the ISIL.
The first shipment of grain from Ukraine is now on its way to Lebanon following inspection in Turkish waters as part of a recent deal between Moscow and Kiev. Cargo was checked by Russian and Ukrainian representatives along with Turkish and UN officials. Ship laden with over 26,000 tons of corn left Ukraine's Odessa port on Monday. It's now on its way to the Lebanese port of Tripoli. 2 weeks ago, Russia and Ukraine inked a deal in Istanbul, which allows Kiev to resume Black Sea grain exports. Blockade of deliveries from the world's two biggest grain exporters hiked food prices worldwide, stoking fears of food insecurity. The Russia-Ukraine grain pact was meant to alleviate some of the global food concerns. Experts in nuclear weapons and technology have gathered in a forum in Seoul to discuss a potential crisis if Pyongyang conducts a seventh nuclear test and related issues this week. Sejong Conference on Non-Proliferation comes as the U.S. and South Korea are set to engage in the largest joint military drills on the Korean Peninsula in 4 years. Our Seoul-based correspondent has your story.
Leading analysts gathered in Seoul, South Korea, and remotely from the United States to discuss North Korea's nuclear weapons program and the potential crisis should Pyongyang conduct a seventh nuclear test. Some admitted past strategies had failed and argued that North Korea's security concerns needed more attention and consideration.
We need to somehow address DPRK's strong motivations, motives for going nuclear. But what we did against DPRK was only strengthening DPRK's incentives to go nuclear.
North Korea suspended its nuclear and long-range missile testing following a 2018 summit between leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump. Now, years later, the U.S.-led sanctions Pyongyang had hoped to see removed remain in place. The discussion of North Korea's nuclear program comes as new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol implements a more hardline approach to Pyongyang. President Yoon has called for the South's military to develop preemptive strike capabilities against the North as part of a so-called kill chain military strategy. President Yoon has also moved to restart suspended large-scale joint military exercises with the U.S., a move that Pyongyang has previously viewed as a provocation of war. The drills are scheduled to take place later this month. Meanwhile, many analysts believe such an approach will lead to greater tension.
The only way to address the risks of accident, misperception, or miscalculation is to try to manage deterrence through risk reduction. Limitations on military exercises, cessation of missile testing, force exclusion zones around the DMZ, sort of a mix of steps that both North Korea and South Korea and the United States would take in the conventional and strategic areas.
Experts also suggest a failure to reduce risks may encourage both South Korea and Japan to develop nuclear weapons themselves. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Thanks for tuning in.
Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, "Perform pilgrimage to Karbala, and don't stop doing this, for Karbala has embraced the best son of the prophets."
In the limelight. In Britain's Conservative leadership contest, Liz Truss has pitched herself as the Education Prime Minister, with a plan that includes replacing failing academies with a new wave of free schools and improving maths and literacy standards. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Press Association, PA Media. The piece is titled, "Liz Truss Pitches Herself as the Education Prime Minister." Please stay with us for more of the article by the Press Association, PA Media. Conservative leadership contest, Liz Truss has pitched herself as the Education Prime Minister, with a plan that includes replacing failing academies with a new wave of free schools and improving maths and literacy standards. The Tory leadership hopeful, whose endorsement by party heavyweights have added to the sense that she's pulling ahead of her rival Rishi Sunak in the race for number 10 Downing Street, unveiled a six-point strategy on Saturday to get Britain's education system back on track. That includes expanding existing academies which are high-performing, while replacing failing ones with free schools, newly set up academies. Academies are state-funded schools that are independent from local authorities. In an often-repeated line of her leadership campaign, Liz Truss said she saw firsthand how children were failed and let down by low expectations during her comprehensive state schooling in Leeds. The remarks have previously drawn criticism from political leaders in the city and former pupils and staff of her former school, Roundhay. Liz Truss, a former Minister for Education and Childcare, also pledged to drive up the quality of maths teaching and meet the target for 90% of primary children to reach the expected standard in literacy and numeracy. She would aim to give working parents access to childcare around the school day and extend the range of providers who accept government childcare entitlements. The Foreign Secretary also said she would follow through on government plans to change staff-to-child ratios for young children, bringing England into line with ratios in Scotland, proposals that the Labour Party has called pathetic. Liz Truss, who studied at Oxford University, promised to reform admissions procedures for Oxbridge and other top universities, so students who get top grades in their A-levels would be automatically invited to apply. Truss said, "My six-point plan will ensure our education system gets back on track by giving every child the tools that they need to succeed." Through a laser-like focus on improving maths and literacy standards, we will make a real difference to children's lives, and by giving families greater choice and flexibility when it comes to childcare, we will also save them money. Truss has previously said she would end the ban on new grammar schools, selective schools that critics say might stretch brighter pupils but increase inequality overall as the attainment of other children suffers. Rishi Sunak has also said he backs their return, but it is understood to mean the expansion of existing grammar schools. The Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has also pledged to help millions of renters buy their first home by making it easier to prove they're ready to take on a mortgage, but said she plans to scrap national house building targets. The frontrunner in the Tory leadership contest vowed to break down barriers to support those keen to get on the housing ladder. A day after outcry over rival Rishi Sunak's plan to block new residential property being built on the Green Belt, which experts said would only exacerbate the housing crisis, Liz Truss risked sparking similar criticism by saying she wanted to abandon top-down Whitehall-imposed housing targets. Official statistics show that more than half of current renters could afford a mortgage, but only 6% are able to access a typical first-time buyer mortgage due to most lenders not taking an applicant's ability to pay a certain amount of rent as proof that they can afford to pay a higher mortgage. Liz Truss said to help Generation Rent, an upcoming review of the system would allow rent payments to be used as part of the affordability assessment for a mortgage. The government is committed to building 300,000 new homes by the mid-2020s. But Liz Truss wants to rip up the red tape that is holding back house building by binning the target. Councils will instead get to choose how many new homes their communities need to build, her team said. But a Truss administration would work with local communities to identify sites ripe for redevelopment and reduce planning restrictions, turbocharging commercial and residential development.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, my very dear sisters. Welcome to Muslim Lady. The month of Muharram is already there, so I offer my condolences to every single one of you, and of course, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And I hope wherever you go and a single teardrop gathers in your eye, you do not forget us from your prayers. And I hope you will get enough of benefits from this month. Keep praying and thinking at the very same time in order to broaden your insight. So today, since it is Muharram, we are going to have some discussion upon the women who participated in the story that created Muharram, actually. The women who have been taken to Karbala with Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This is Asma, your humble host, and here with me I have my very dear sister, Sister Sadiqah. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to Muslim Lady.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Of course, I'm in here. Well, sister, just before we start, can you please give us a very short introduction about your field of study?
Yes, so I have just finished my bachelor's equivalent in the field of jurisprudential studies.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at the way laws are derived, Islamic laws are derived, and the different principles that go into deriving a law.
Interesting.
And I've just started my master's program.
Yeah.
I'm into the same field, which looks at how laws are derived and... how the Quran and the traditions and different principles are used to derive a specific law.
Very interesting, actually. Loads of luck. I wish you loads of luck.
Thank you.
Hope you do great in whatever you're doing. So, sister, today we're going to talk about the women who participated in Karbala and the fact that Imam Hussein took these women with him into a battlefield.
Exactly. So, based on the research that I did, the reading that I did around this subject,
mm-hmm.
first, it is a lot of the people kept on telling Imam Hussein not to take his women with him. There are a lot of books written on this subject as
exactly,
to why
yeah.
Imam Hussein chose to first go off to Karbala anyways, and then why he chose to take the women with him. Now, if you look at the political surrounding of that time, Imam Hussein was first threatened with... murder. He was going to be killed within Medina itself if he refused to give the oath of allegiance to the ruler of the time, Yazid.
Exactly, yeah.
So Imam Hussein, in order to not be killed within Medina, moves towards Mecca. But he takes his family with him and his women specifically. Again from Mecca, there's again a threat of his killing, so again he leaves. Now at that time, the people of Kufa have invited him. Kufa is a city in Iraq. And they had invited him, telling him that we are here for you. We want you to come and preach to us. And
yeah.
if you do not, you're not working according to your responsibility.
And so much of people wrote those letters.
Yeah, exactly. We have numbers that say up to 18,000 people signed those
Which
letters.
Which is a huge number in that time.
And it is a very huge number. And Imam Hussein took all these letters with him. Now, if we look at the political time, It was a time where people were more concerned about their own stomachs and their own peace, state of peace, rather than religion. Religion had completely disintegrated.
Yeah,
right?
That's why actually Imam Hussein alayhi salam started to move to teach the people about the basics of the Islam.
Exactly. So when we look at the whole history, we'll see that Imam Hussein, from what I have concluded, is that when Imam Hussein took his women with him, he was basically showing them step by step what's happening. They were getting a first-hand view of history and politics surrounding that time. You see, to hear politics is different than to see it firsthand. Yeah. So when the women accompanied Imam Hussein in every step, so they saw what happened in Medina, they see what happens in Makkah. In Makkah, you had a lot of people coming to Imam Hussein. Some were well-wishers, and some were only concerned with their own power, like we have Abdullah ibn Zubair.
Yeah.
Whose only role was to drive Imam Hussein from Makkah so he could get rulership over Makkah.
Yeah.
So these women are looking in the history, they're looking at politics building over time, so they're able to understand why Imam Hussein is doing what he's doing, because this is going to be very important in the future.
So it's actually working as a justification for all those women.
It is, yes, it is working to show these women are learning and they're seeing history firsthand, mm-hmm. because they're going to carry this forward. They're going to narrate these historical instances
That's
in
the
future.
Point. Yes, they're going to be the narrator of these stories.
Exactly. Then Imam Hussein from Makkah to Kufa, there are many places where he stops and he meets different people. Some of these people he meets are people from Kufa who deny that they wrote the letters to the Imam while they have the signatures in them.
Yeah.
So Imam, the reason Imam Hussein even has those letters, he throws it in front of them and tells them, you wrote these letters to me. You're denying it now. These women are seeing this. Okay. Now let's get to Karbala. All right. The army of Imam Hussein. It wasn't not really an army. The few companions and family of Imam Hussein are barricaded from the water. And they're not allowed to have access to water for up to 3 days. Then the day of the battle comes, right? So Imam Hussein, none of the imams ever, if they had a war, they never went to the battle themselves. So that day, Imam Hussein goes to the battle. Again, he tells them, you wrote letters to me. And he calls these people by the names. And boldly, courageously, these people reply, we did not write letters to you. Well, those letters are with Imam Hussein. Now, the women are seeing these, okay? The women don't have a role as yet. Yeah. Right now, they're witnesses to these events. Their role now starts after Karbala ends, right? So they did have a role in those battles, right? They did have a role as encouraging. We do have history where Imam Hussein had his six-month-old baby, when his six-month-old baby was killed because Imam Hussein took him to the battlefield to ask for water since he was almost dying of thirst. When he goes back to the tent, it is said that his mother actually went to the end of the tent so Imam Hussein would not feel ashamed.
Yeah.
So these women had this role. They understood the role of the Imam, right?
They were strong.
They were strong and they understood the complete role that the Imam played, right? So they had cognizance of the Imam, which is more important than anything that we need when it comes to understanding why Imam Hussein did what he did. Let's leave Karbala. Now the real role of the women start. They are made into captives.
So until now we got that they had to take part in this journey in order to be a
witness.
Proof and also in order for them to be the narrator of this story.
To narrate and witness because they needed to learn the political circumstances of the time. You see that the people who wrote the letters to the Imam are now denying it. So you can see how history is changing. They're doing one thing, but they're denying it.
Yeah.
If the women were not there to narrate, then perhaps these people would have allowed their lives to take over. You see, when Imam Hussein was killed and these women were captivated and taken, all through whichever city they were taken through, they were introduced as those who were rebellious against the caliphate. They were not introduced as the family of the Prophet. They were introduced as those who were rebellious. So they were trying to change history.
Yeah, to hide it, to hide the truth.
Yes. So Yazid and his army were trying to change history to completely hide the real identity of Imam Hussein. And this is where the women come in. So we know Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam, the daughter of Imam Ali, the sister of Imam Hussein, she delivers several sermons. We have two of her famous ones, one in the court of Ibn Ziyad in Kufa, and another one in the court of Yazid in Sham, which is to modern-day Damascus.
Both of which are very important.
Very important. When she goes to
and
Damascus...
And they played a great role. They enlightened many people.
Exactly. And they, when she gets into Kufa, and the people are crying, right? Because now they have been told that this is the family of the Prophet.
Yeah.
And she doesn't...
Now they get to know who they are facing.
Now they get to understand the result of the actions.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't start off in any way. She starts off by saying, cry because you deserve to cry.
Okay.
Because you have done this with your own hands. You invited my brother and then turned against him.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm paraphrasing this. I'm not narrating the exact.
Yes,
this
yes,
we can look in other segments.
This is all that the time is giving us.
Yes, because of we can look into these sermons inshallah at a later time. Or people and anyone can easily read it because they have
They're
been translated.
Available.
In English online.
Yeah.
Then she starts to narrate the position
mm-hmm.
and what they have done. And this sermon can be said to have made the people feel so remorseful that they started to actively work against overthrowing Yazid.
Yes, yes.
And we know within 3 years Yazid died, and particularly this event of Ashura led to the fall of the Umayyad dynasty.
Exactly. They wished the other way. They thought that
exactly.
they're going to destroy them fully and people would forget about them and
exactly.
all. But the lectures of Lady Zainab did a great deal of job.
Yes. And then she goes to Sham. Now, it's not only Hazrat Zainab who delivered. We actually have narration that Imam Sajjad, the other son of Imam Hussein,
exactly,
delivered.
Yeah.
We have some that say the other daughters of Imam Hussein delivered their own sermons. So each one of them had their own
mm-hmm.
sermons that they delivered, telling the people what they have brought upon themselves and what they've done to the family of the Prophet.
Yeah, that's
Then she
true.
Goes into Damascus, modern-day Damascus, which in those days was Sham. And she... Now, Yazid was the ruler who thought he had won over Imam Hussein. And in that sermon, she proves to the people that the rulership of Yazid was illegitimate because of historical inferences that had happened, historical circumstances that had taken place in the past. And in this sermon, she proves how Yazid's rulership was illegitimate, exactly what Imam Hussein had tried to say at the start of his journey.
Yeah.
She completes it, and that's when the people start to realize that Yazid had no right to be in power. And that this whole event then leads, as time goes on, it leads to the collapse of the Umayyad dynasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, dear audience, I think we're going to follow this session because there are plenty much of stories that the sister told us and we enjoyed it plenty much. Thank you for sharing that with us, sister. And thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us once more. I offer my condolences to you all for the month of Muharram and the sorrow of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And I ask you not to forget us in your prayers. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. played an unacknowledged role in the 2017 bombing of an internally displaced persons camp in Nigeria that killed more than 160 civilians, many of them children. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Nick Terse, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. played secret role in Nigeria attack that killed more than 160 civilians. Here's more. The United States played an unacknowledged role in the 2017 bombing of an internally displaced persons camp in Nigeria that killed more than 160 civilians, many of them children. A surveillance plane circled above the RAN IDP camp, which housed 43,000 people and was controlled by the Nigerian military, before a jet arrived and bombed the area where people draw water from a borehole, survivors of the attack said. The jet then circled and dropped another bomb on the tents of displaced civilians sheltering there. The Nigerian Air Force expressed regret for carrying out the airstrike, which also killed 9 aid workers and seriously wounded more than 120 people. But the attack was referred to as an instance of U.S.-Nigerian operations in a formerly secret U.S. military document obtained exclusively by The Intercept. Evidence suggests that the U.S. launched a near-unprecedented internal investigation of the attack because it secretly provided intelligence or other support to the Nigerian armed forces, a contribution hinted at by Nigerian military officials at the time. The U.S. inquiry, the existence of which has not been previously reported, was ordered by the top American general overseeing troops in Africa and was specifically designed to avoid questions of wrongdoing or recommendations for disciplinary action, according to the document, conducted as part of a long-running counterinsurgency campaign against the terrorist group Boko Haram. The January 17, 2017 attack on the camp located in Ran, Nigeria, near the Cameroonian and Chadian borders, also destroyed at least 35 structures, including shelters for war victims who had been forced from their homes. The Nigerian Air Force bombed the internally displaced persons camp, which had been set up by the Nigerian military, because the location was not reflected in the operational map as a humanitarian base, according to Major General John Ehang, Nigeria's Director of Defense Information, adding, hence, it appeared as a place that could equally be used for enemy activities. Nigerian human rights activists questioned how the military could be unaware of the camp and alleged a cover-up. The tents were visible from the air, according to satellite imagery. Last year, Agnes Callamard, then United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions, noted the absurdity of the strike. The military presence in Ran, its role in establishing the camp, and their facilitation of the humanitarian distribution on the day raised many questions, she wrote in a 2021 report, adding, no independent investigation was carried out. Just days after the attack, U.S. Africa Command secretly commissioned Brigadier General Frank J. Stokes to undertake an investigation to determine the facts and circumstances of a kinetic airstrike conducted by the Nigerian military forces in the vicinity of Ran, Nigeria. Its findings were never made public. AFRICOM did not answer The Intercept's questions about the results of Stokes' investigation or the extent of U.S. involvement in the attack. Civilian victims and the American and Nigerian publics deserve answers about any U.S. role in this devastating strike, said Annie Schill, senior advisor for the U.S. at the Center for Civilians in Conflict or Civic. What exactly was the U.S. involvement? What were the findings of the investigation, including findings of wrongdoing? And what kind of responsibility does the U.S. acknowledge for the grave harm caused? the formerly secret document directed to Stokes, Deputy Director of AFRICOM's Directorate for Strategy Engagements and Programs, to be sensitive regarding the assessment of materials maintained within special access programs, often referred to CAPS, sometimes called black programs. This program is highly classified with a strictly enforced security measures and need-to-know access requirements. Certain programs are unacknowledged, their findings and funding hidden within the federal budget, and their existence formally denied. Spokesperson Kelly Callahan said AFRICOM was not involved in the bombing of Ran IDP camp, but secret and low-profile programs on the African continent can be carried out by the CIA or special operations forces under their own chains of command. While AFRICOM takes responsibility for drone strikes, for example, they are generally carried out by a Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, task force. Retired Brigadier General Donald Baldock, Chief of Special Operations Command Africa at the time of the Ran strike, told The Intercept in 2018 that although JSOC was required to coordinate and de-conflict through his headquarters, that didn't always happen. I get a phone call and someone will say, "What are you doing in that area when we weren't aware of you were there?" And I'll say, "I wasn't in the area, so I don't know," Baldock said at the time, adding, "Later you come to find out it was a JSOC element doing something that undermines trust. It's not a good thing." U.S. surveillance and intelligence gathering operations have often been employed near Nigeria, including a Predator drone flown from neighboring Chad, in addition to a longer-range Global Hawk and a manned turboprop plane deployer over Nigeria beginning in 2014, ostensibly to search for children kidnapped by Boko Haram. In neighboring Niger, the U.S. flew drones from bases in Derku and Niamey. In 2016, The Intercept reported on a secretive drone base in Garoua, Cameroon, near the Nigerian border, employing drones which could carry out 24-hour surveillance, allowing U.S. intelligence analysts to gather detailed information about Boko Haram's movements, bomb-making factories, and military camps. Also mentioned were British, French, and U.S. intelligence units based in Abuja, Nigeria, Maroua, Cameroon, and Njamena, Chad, serving as clear houses for intelligence about Boko Haram. That same year, the process by which the U.S. provided information like aerial surveillance photos to aid Nigeria's fight against Boko Haram was streamlined from as many as 2 weeks to 1 hour. The New York Times reported, specifically noting that drone photos were provided to the Nigerian army. In 2017, The Intercept also revealed the existence of a drone base and torture center used by U.S. contractors in Salak, Cameroon, in the northern border region between Nigeria and Chad. Callahan, the spokesperson, insisted that AFRICOM had no additional information on the Ran airstrike, but did not respond to a question of how this was possible, given that then AFRICOM commander General Thomas D. Waldhauser had ordered to top AFRICOM officer to conduct a formal investigation that included gathering accounts of the strike or information from witnesses, inspecting documents, and collecting information which will support any subsequent reviews of the strike and shape the manner in which any future coalition or partner nation operations are conducted. Earlier this year, The Intercept revealed how U.S. targeting assessments carried out for another allied military led to a 2015 airstrike on an ISIS bomb factory in Hawija, Iraq, that touched off secondary explosions, killing at least 85 civilians. In the wake of that Dutch airstrike, the chief of targets for U.S. Central Command insisted that the attack had been conducted by the book, including the pre-strike collateral damage estimate, or CDE. This was a perfectly accurate CDE call. He insisted, emphasizing that CDE methodology does not account for secondary explosions. No Americans were held accountable for the civilian deaths in the Hawija strike, in keeping with the litany of attacks from Somalia to Libya and from Syria to Yemen that the Pentagon has failed to investigate or reinvestigate, despite civilian casualty allegations. Earlier this year, Representative Sarah Jacobs of California asked whether the Defense Department was planning to revisit civilian harm allegations for cases in which new evidence has come to light. Exactly how many people were killed in the bombing remains unknown. Calamar, the UN Special Rapporteur, was provided a list with the names of 127 victims, two-thirds of them children. Witnesses involved in the burial say 167 victims were interred in Ron Cemetery, while a local government official put the number at 236 dead. Witnesses described finding large numbers of ball bearings following the bombing. Photos of the dead and wounded, according to Calamar's report, also showed both massive and smaller wounds consistent with firing of ball bearings-based ammunitions. The allegations that such munitions were used are extremely serious, Calamar noted, and should have been independently investigated. Experts say the U.S. government needs to come clean about its involvement in the Iran airstrike and other similar instances around the world that the U.S. may be keeping secret.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.